Vayera, chapter 18 of the book of Genesis, Bereshit, begins, "And Yahuwah appeared," which is where the word Vayera comes from, "unto him, Abraham, by the terebinths at Mamre, as he sat in his tent door in the heat of the day. And he looked up, lifted up his eyes, and lo, there were three men. So he ran to meet them, and he said, 'My lord, Adoni, if I've now found favor in your sight, don't pass away, but let me go get you some water, wash your feet, have a rest here under the tree, and I will fetch you a morsel of bread and stay your heart. After that, you can head on, for as much as you're come to your servant.' And they said, okay, go do as you've said. So he went to his tent unto Sarah. He told Sarah to quickly go get some fine meal and make some cakes. Then he went unto the herd. He fetched a calf, a good one, gave it to the servant. And that servant went off to dress it. And he took, this is interesting too, because he's actually mixing milk and meat here. Some will observe that. He took curd, milk, and the calf which he dressed, set it before them. And they all ate under the tree. And they said to him, 'Where is your wife Sarah?' 'Behold,' he said, 'she's in the tent.'" And now we see that it still says at this point, "he." The King James capitalizes it because in about three more verses, we're going to see this change. It actually does address one of the three men as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh with the tetragrammaton. But at this point it says, "He said, 'I'll return to you when the season comes around, and lo, your wife Sarah is going to have a son.' Sarah heard him in the tent door, which was behind them." And now we get this little parenthetical note. Hey, in case you've forgotten, Sarah and Abraham were pretty old at this point. "Well stricken in age," says the English here. "It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. She has not had a period in a while. She does not believe that it's possible for her to have a child. And as verse 12 says, as a result of that, she laughed within herself. 'Am I, after I've waxed old, to have pleasure, my Lord being old also?'" Now let's pause for a second, because that word there, and we mentioned this last week, the word is going to show up a number of times this week. I find this word to be really fascinating. It's ve-tit-chak. That's a hard one to pronounce. It's got a het and a kof in there. Ve-tit-chak. Same root, right? You recognize the root there, yitzach. Laughter. Sarah laughed within herself. It doesn't sound like she laughed out loud. It sounds like this is just quite an internal chuckle. And I'm going to pause for a second, make a couple of comments on this. But before we do that, at least let's note that Yahuwah, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, then says unto Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Surely shall I, who am old, bear a child?' Is anything too hard for Yahuwah? At the set time, I'll return unto you. When the season comes around, Sarah shall have a son." Sarah denies it, saying, "No, I didn't really laugh. Lo, zachati, for she was afraid." "No, but you did laugh," he said. So the men rose up. They looked out towards Sodom, and Abraham went along to bring them along the way. And then we get another aspect of the story. But I want to pause there, make a couple of comments. Now, this is one of those things that you cannot prove from Scripture, but neither can I disprove it. So I'll just pass it along. And that is that the sages claim, since we've just recently seen that Abraham and all of his house had been circumcised, that something like maybe 3 days have passed since this time. And that would mean that Abraham is still kind of having a little bit of pain, if you think about it. And as I, you know, was reminded of that this night, and I noticed that Sarah laughed within herself, you're thinking, well, maybe there's more to this, right? She's thinking, Abraham's not in a position right now to do much of anything. Matter of fact, the sages have suggested that when it comes to him getting up and running and going to get a calf, that's a pretty amazing statement as to the youthfulness and visage of this fella that he's able to even get around after that kind of thing. So when you put all this in perspective, this idea of laughter is certainly interesting. Now, I've said this before. Every year when I come to this, it seems to me to be more and more the case. Now, this is just my understanding. So this is, if you will, Markology. This is the way I read this. You're certainly not required to read it the same way. But this idea of laughter to me is key. We know that the son is going to be named with this root word, yitzach, having to do with laughter. And it's not, in this case, I don't think at all a derisive kind of a laughter. I tend to think of it more as a joyful kind of a thing. And even Sarah, you know, assuming that, and I suspect that she did, she probably does believe that this could happen. But you still got to admit, it's kind of an amazing thing. All right, but we'll come back to that. The men then rose up. They looked out towards Sodom. Abraham went to bring him on their way. And now Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says something else that's interesting. Shall I hide from Abraham that which I am doing? Seeing that he is surely, remember that's the prophecy, I've told him this, he shall surely become a great and mighty nation. All the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I've known him to the end that he may command his children and his household after him, that they may keep the way of Yahuwah to do righteousness and justice, to the end that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh may bring upon Abram, now Abraham, all that he has spoken of him. And then Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said, verily, the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great. Their sin is, it's incredible. It's exceedingly grievous in the King James. So I'm going to go down now and see firsthand. He's given them every opportunity, it sounds like. Obviously, he already knows the situation. But I'm going to go down and see whether they have done all together according to the cry of it, which comes to me. If not, I'll know. So those the men, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and the other two Malachim, turned. They went toward Sodom. But Abraham stood still before him, and he drew near. And this is where we see one of the, more interesting character revelations about a fellow who's going to dicker with the Almighty in a very humble fashion, but nevertheless somewhat persistently. Some might even say, almost too persistently. So here's how it goes. Will you indeed, he says, sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Just suppose, peradventure in the old King James, there might be 50 righteous folks within that city. Will you indeed sweep away and not forgive the place for those 50 righteous that are therein? Hey, he continues, that would be far from you to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. That be far from you. Shall not the judge of the earth do justly? This is bordering on impertinence. But it shows the character of Abraham. Here he is with an opportunity to be very concerned. Now, I'm sure he is aware that Lot is in the city too. But shall not the judge of the earth do justly? He's asking some questions. He is doing to a great extent what Moshe later does the same way. He is reminding the creator of the universe of things that he knows full well, but nevertheless that are part of his character, part of the in his name, part of his nature. Kinds of things. He gets a response. Yahuwah says, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, well, then I'll forgive the whole place for their sake. And Abraham, he's, I guess you'd say, increasingly motivated now. He says, well, behold then, I've kind of stepped out of line here. I have taken it upon me to speak unto Yahuwah. Who am I but dust and ashes? So let's just suppose that now there would be, almost 50, but we're 5 short. Will you destroy all the city for lack of that 5? Response, I will not destroy it if I find there 40 and 5. Okay, well, that sounds good, right? Let's keep on going, seems to be the motivation. Peradventure, how about if we get 40? The response, no, I won't do it for the 40's sake. And then Abraham continues, let not Yahuwah be angry, and I will speak. Peradventure, how about if we find 30? Remember the old joke? We're dickering price at this point. We're on a roll. He said, I won't do it, not if I find 30 there. Behold, now, I've taken it upon myself, now just hang with me here, to speak unto Yahuwah. Suppose, peradventure, we find 20. I will not destroy it for the 20's sake. And Abraham isn't done yet. Let not Yahuwah be angry. And I'll speak yet, as last time I promise. Peradventure, how about if we get 10 righteous men? Now, some of you may remember, this is what's called in the Hebrew a minion of 10. How about if we just got 10? Response, he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of the 10. And then Yahuwah went on his way, soon as he left off speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned unto his place. Now, this is interesting for a couple reasons. Set it aside for now. We're going to come back to it. But I want to just note the kinds of things that seem to, if you will, cause Abraham to step up, arguably leave his comfort zone, and start asking some of the important questions. He's good at that. Long time later, what we have is the dickering is finished. We'll pick it up there. The two angels came into Sodom at evening, and we're going to see Lot there. I'm going to go through this story relatively fast because there's so much other stuff that we need to make sure we talk about, and this is another one of these Torah portions that's just chock full. What I want to do is just kind of address some of the problematic issues, if you will, with the character of Lot. Lot rises up to meet him, and he too invites him into the house, says similar things. He seems to have the form, anyway, of what to do. Tarry here tonight, wash your feet, rise up early. And they came in, he made them a feast too. But before they lay down, all the men of the city, these are the wicked folks in Sodom, came around the house, people from every quarter, and they started taunting him and basically saying, where are those men that came in? Bring them out to us that we may know them. Basically, let's be blunt here, that they are going to want to gang rape them. Lot went out, shut the door, and he said, I pray you, my brethren, don't do so wickedly. Hey! Now, this is one of those problematic things. Is he lying? There's something really wrong with this statement that Lot makes. Behold, I have two daughters that have not known man. Later on, we're going to find out that they have, nevertheless, husbands. You've got to wonder about what the real story is here and what the men are saying when these guys are offering up their, when the father's offering up their wives to be gang raped by some other folks. Do as you like with them. Only, you know, for these guys, don't do anything. They're under the shadow of my roof. Well, basically, the crowd isn't having it. And they drew down to break down the door. Meanwhile, the Malachim, the messengers, put forth their hand. They shut the door. They smote the men that were outside with blindness, all of them. So they wearied themselves trying to find the door. They, however, were still persistent, which is kind of interesting. They're not. Just, you know, a little blindness isn't stopping them. You got to wonder. Lot's getting the message. You got your son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, anybody that you have, bring them out. We're going to destroy this place because the cry of them has waxed great before Yahuwah. So Lot goes out. He speaks to his son-in-laws, the ones who were married to those daughters that he was fixing to give up for the crowd. And they don't believe him. They think he is jesting with them. Guess what? They think he is laughing, mocking. Same root word. Zachak. When the morning arose, the messengers told Lot, get your wife, your two daughters, out of here, lest they be swept away with the iniquity of the city. But he lingered. They were merciful to him, nevertheless, still brought him outside the city. Run for your life is basically the message. Don't look back either. Do not look behind you. Stay in the plain, all the way to the mountain. Oh, says Lot, if I found grace in your sight, let me just go to some other place. That ends up being the place of Zoar. So Lot is eventually allowed to go there. And Sodom and Gomorrah have fire and brimstone rained down upon them by Yahuwah. He overthrew the cities, all the plain, and the inhabitants of the cities which grew upon the ground. Verse 26 tells us, and I remember as a kid, this picture, hearing the story, you know, in Sunday school. Lot's wife turns around, glances over her shoulder. She sees this, mushroom cloud or the fire and brimstone or whatever it is, and is turned into a pillar of salt, right? Everybody's got this picture, great big pillar of salt there. I don't think that's necessarily exactly what is saying. The root, though, it seems to be that she didn't just look back. She looked back. You with me? There's a slight difference in the attitude that is described here. Oh, wistfully, longingly, as opposed to just, I'm out of there, good riddance. Abraham, who, too, he gets up, he sees, lo, the smoke of the land went up. Came to pass that when Elohim had destroyed the cities of the plain, that Elohim remembered Abraham. He sent Lot out of the midst. Lot goes up out of Zoar, he dwelt in the mountain, his two daughters with him. We know what happens next. Did Zoar get wiped out too? At least not there. It looks like he went to Zoar. That's the way I've always read it. Anyway, when Lot goes there. He got basically leave to go there. And it may have been destroyed after he left. And on that score, I guess, I'm not sure. Anyway, what we have is the two daughters conspiring essentially to commit incest with their father. First one gets him drunk. Well, they both get him drunk. First one goes into him. Come on, they say, let's get our dad drunk. We'll lie with him because we're the only ones left. So the firstborn went in, lay with her father. It says here he did not know when she lay down with him or when she arose. You think he had any clue about what's going on? I got to suspect that he did. That's just me. Came to pass on the next day. Firstborn told the younger one, behold, I lay last night with our dad. Let's get him drunk again. You go in this time. Lie with him. We'll preserve our seed. Here's the thing, I guess, that sticks out at me in this particular part of the story. And this is where I want to tie together a couple of things about Lot. It looks to me, as I look at the character of Lot and see all the stuff that's going on, we've got a number of pieces of the picture here. Lot is not explicitly described in Scripture as a Torah breaker. He seems to go through the motions. Yet, on the other hand, we see that this character of Abram is a whole different thing. He is filled with chesed, with kindness. You know, if you're looking for a character in the Bible that really knows how to make strangers and people feel welcome, you know, if you looked him up in the Bible dictionary, there'd be Abraham's picture, is kind of the way you think of it. Lot seems to have been more or less a bystander through all of this. He is watching, but his heart doesn't seem to be in it. Almost, if you've ever heard the description of a sociopath. Now, I'm not saying that Lot is a sociopath. I'm just saying that there are certain characteristics that are kind of similar here. A sociopath is someone who doesn't really feel what's going on, but they can sometimes mimic it. If it behooves them, they can picture what they should be doing, and they can go along with the motions. And if anything, that, to my mind, is kind of the character of Lot. It's the distinguishing thing. It's what we see with Lot. You know, when it comes to dealing with the angels and the daughters, well, he kind of thinks he ought to be doing something here, but what he does not strike us as being necessarily right. And that's consistent. And it finally, I guess, comes to a head with the situation with the two daughters. You ask yourself the question, okay, he gets drunk the first night, and maybe you could say, all right, he was caught off guard, didn't know what's going on. And yet on night two, he's going to let him do it again? Right? I got drunk last night. Don't remember what happened, but I think I liked it. I'm going to let it happen again. Again, what's wrong with this picture? I guess how I would describe it is... Well, there's a couple words we'd use in the English. Willful blindness. See no evil. I'm just going to not look there because I don't want to see what I know I'm going to see. I'm not going to ask the question because I don't want to hear the answer. I'm not going to explicitly violate the Torah, mind you, but I'm just going to kind of go with the flow. And if it happens, hey, who would have known? Who could have possibly seen it? He just allowed the occasion of sin, if you will, to kind of come upon him. Another aspect of the character study. Well, out of those two daughters, we come up with two peoples, both of whom kind of have some issues. The first one, his name is Moab. That's the father of the Moabites. The younger, she had a son too, Ben-Ami, literally son of my father. And he is the father of the children of the Ammonites. All right, back to chapter 20, where Abraham, he journeys towards the land of the south, and he sojourned in Gerar. He said, once again, same mistake we've seen before, here is my sister. This time it's Abimelech, king of Gerar, that took Sarah, Lechach, literally took her. We know what that word means. He puts her in a position of, you know, I'm going to come and have carnal knowledge of her pretty soon now. But verse 3 tells us that Elohim came to Abimelech in a dream and said to him, look at, hey, beware here, you're fixing to die. Because the woman you've taken, she's another man's wife. Now, Abimelech, it says, at this point hadn't come near her. And he said, Yahuwah, will you slay even a righteous man? Didn't this guy himself say to me, she's my sister? She herself said too, he's my brother. In the simplicity of my heart and in the innocence of my hands have I done this thing. Yeah, says God, I know that you've done this in the simplicity of your heart. Hey, that sounds a bit like Lot, doesn't it? And I've withheld you from sinning against me. I suffered her, or you, not to touch her or one another. Now, therefore, restore this man's wife. He's a prophet. He will pray for you, and you'll live. But if you don't restore her, no, of a surety. This is the mot temut. Mot temut. Same root word twice. Mot, mot. Basically, dying, you shall die. You are in a world of hurt here, dude, unless you straighten up and fly right. Know of a certainty that dying, you shall die. And by the way, everyone else is with you. In other words, another way to think of it, more modern parlance, you're already dead. You're a dead man unless you get right here. Abimelech rose early in the morning. He called his servants, and he told all of these things to them. And the men were upset. They were afraid. Then he called Abraham. He said, "What have you done to us? What have I done to you that you brought all of this upon me and my kingdom, this great sin? You've done things unto me that ought not to be done. What were you thinking here that you've done this thing?" Well, Abraham says, "I thought surely the fear of God is not in this place." Now pause there for a second. He's telling this fella, the king of this land, Gerar, "Quite frankly, I didn't trust you guys. You're not God-fearing folks. They'll slay me. I guess what I'm telling you is I didn't necessarily have great faith in your character." Hey, maybe he's talking about modern America, too. "You'd slay me for my wife's sake. She's attractive. You want her? You'll kill me. And by the way, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. Half-sister. Maybe she's a nephew or a brother's daughter, a niece. It's not clear. There's some argument in Scripture. We talked about that here of late. But nevertheless, she did become my wife. So, it's kind of the Clintonian truth. Huh? What I told you was true. It just wasn't the whole truth. Anyway, it came to pass, when Elohim caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her," this is the thing, that's this kindness you should show to me. Every place where we come, you say, "He's my brother. He ain't heavy." "Abimelech took sheep and oxen, men servants, women servants, gave them unto Abraham, and he restored Sarah to him, and he said, 'Okay, look here, the whole land is before you. Dwell wherever you'd like to go.' And unto Sarah he said, 'Look, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It's for thee a covering of the eyes and all that are with you. Before all men you are righted.'" In other words, I'm restoring to you your honor. Now, this part is interesting. "Do Abraham prayed unto Elohim," it says, "and he healed Abimelech, his wife, his maidservants, and they bore children." We don't know how long all this took, but it must have been a while. Because Yahuwah, it says, had closed up tight all the wombs of the house of Abimelech just because of this problem with Sarai, now Sarah. Verse 21 tells us something in the Hebrew. This is one of those little Rashi-isms that is kind of worth mentioning as we go across. It says, in my King James-ish rendering here, with the Hebrew on the one side and the English on the other, "And Yahuwah remembered Sarah as he had said." But really, the Hebrew scholars, and again I point to Rashi in specific, says that the more appropriate way to think of this is Yahuwah had remembered. Okay? In other words, at the time where this has happened, he has already remembered Sarah and his promise to Sarah. It's not just because he did something that all of a sudden, "Oh, I forgot her, and I'm remembering her." No, he had already remembered Sarah. Now, what Rashi suggests is, if you look at the verses and you read this in context, it is the fact that Abraham prayed to Elohim on behalf of somebody else to have his wife and house restored, that at that instant, it was the prayer of the righteous man for someone else in a similar situation that essentially brings to pass the prophecy that was already in place regarding Sarah. Does that make sense? I find that to be at least an interesting understanding, and I think it makes sense, and it's the kind of thing that is a little bit nuanced. You don't necessarily see it in the English, but it is kind of cool in the Hebrew. So, Abraham prays, the sequence goes, for Abimelech, whose wife has also been sealed.
they bear children. And then in chapter 21, we find out, look at this. Yahuwah has already remembered Sarah, and he has already done as he promised that he would do. So it's the prayer, at least according to some of the sages, of this man for someone else that restores his situation. I guess there's a lesson in there, at least if we read it that way. You got a problem? Understand that there may be other people with the same problem. And sometimes it's the compassion, it's the chesed thing that kind of helps to bring already existent promises to fruition. Well, Sarah conceived. She bore Abraham a son in his old age at the exact set time which Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had said to him. He called the name of the son, as has been prophesied, whom Sarah bore to him, Yitzhak, laughter. And he circumcised Yitzhak when he was 8 days old, just as he was commanded. And then it tells us Abraham was 100 years old when his son Yitzhak was born. And Sarah says the following, Elohim has made laughter for me. Zachach, for everyone that hears, will laugh on account of me. Now, I keep repeating this because I think it's just so amazing. When she says this, you get the idea. This is not just a funny ha-ha story. This is a joyfully wonderful story. They will share my joy, my laughter, my unbridled, overwhelming laughter at my son, who I'm going to name on this and in this way. Who would have said unto Abraham and to Sarah that she would give children suck? For I have borne him a son in his old age. Oh, wow! Laugh about that. The child grew, was weaned. Abraham makes a feast. Sarah, at this point, sees the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she'd born, making sport, teasing, funning. And there's even an implication in the Hebrew that there was a sexual aspect to this. Like he was somehow playing with the young boy. Not a good thing, whatever. But you know what's interesting here? This, now you'll notice this, in a lot of Hebrew words you have this characteristic. The same word, depending upon vowel pointers and context, can have a very positive meaning or a very negative meaning. And guess what? The word here that is used is same root word, zachach, laughter. He wasn't laughing with Isaac, he was laughing at him. This was a derisive, abusive thing that's going on in this case. So Sarah says to her husband Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. She ain't going to be heir with my son, even with Isaac. And Abraham is very upset. Verse 11 says this was very grievous. And now Elohim counsels Abraham, don't let it be grievous in your sight because of the lad, because of the bondwoman. Listen, hearken, Shema, unto Sarah. It's Isaac that your seed will be called through. Of this bondwoman and her son, I'll make a great nation because he is your seed too. Don't sweat that, Abraham. Abraham arose early in the morning, took bread and a bottle of water, and he gave it to Hagar. He put it on her shoulder and he shalacht her. He sent her out of his house. He put her away in the English. He didn't give her a get, evidently, you'll note. Interestingly enough, she departed. She went out into the desert, Bemidbar. Eventually she ran out of water, and the story gets kind of gnarly at that point. Now let's pause for a second, because at this point, this is one of those little interesting observations that comes from Rabbi David Foreman. A couple of things that he points out that if you'll compare the picture here, and you start to see how many things all of a sudden begin to fall into place. I'm not going to claim that this is one of those, it's a done deal, now we understand it all, but certainly within the Torah there are foreshadowings, there are bookends, there are things that the Torah reveals to us that we later see playing out. For example, it starts when we're told about this woman Hagar a while back. She's a bondservant, a maidservant. She is, what's her nationality, right? Everybody remembers? She's an Egyptian. She's a Mitzrayite. Why does it tell us that? What significance does that possibly have? Remember, there's no idle word in Torah. Why would it bother to say this? We also know that there's this prophecy having to do with Abram. Later, Abraham. Your seed is going to be in bondage for 400 years. Well, we know where that's going to be, right? Mitzrayim, Egypt. But wait. Abraham doesn't know yet where it's going to be. He hasn't been told, right? There are elements of this picture that start to fall into place. What happens when he sends this woman, when he shallocks her? He does something. He gives her bread and water. He sends her out. The woman and her son go out into where? The desert. Later on, 400 years or so later on, what is going to happen to the sons of Abraham? They're going to take water, bread. They're going to go out into the desert. Matter of fact, it's pretty much the same desert. They're both going to get waylaid, lost. They're going to spend more time there than they want to. They're going to run out of water. They're going to get thirsty. The parallels are just kind of amazing. Let me not look upon the death of the child, she says, when they run out of water. She lifts up her voice and she weeps. And here Elohim, again, prophetically, he shall hear. That's what the child is named for. And there's a Melech, a Malach, of an angel, if you will, messenger of Elohim, called to Hagar out of heaven, says to her, what's the problem here? Fear not, for Yahuwah has heard the voice, Elohim has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, I'll make of him a great nation. Elohim opens her eyes. She sees a well of water, a miracle, right there in the desert. Gee, that too sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? A miracle in the desert, she drinks. So does the boy. He grew, he dwelt in the land. There's more to the story, though, too. And this is the thing that I think is really interesting. Remember when we see, after the story of Egypt, a lot of times when we're reminded, hey, you remember, you too were a stranger. Don't abuse the stranger that dwells among you. You too were a stranger in Mitzrayim. Think about that word Hagar, the name of the Egyptian woman, at least the title. What does Hagar mean in Hebrew? The stranger. Don't abuse the stranger. You too were a stranger in the land of Mitzrayim. I find all of this fascinating. Where the character, the pieces, how it all fits together, the kind of person that Abraham is. What upsets Abraham? What upsets him here are things that look like abuse. He doesn't want to see Hagar go out in the wilderness. He may be sending her to her death. That bothers him, and rightfully so. It's the kind of guy he is. He's had some of these interesting prophecies. He has to be told by Elohim in this particular case. Listen, it's the second situation that we've seen that's a problem with Hagar. Now, there's a little scene that happens here. Once again, Abimelech, my son, king, and he meets with Abraham in the desert. They make a pact over the well at Beersheba, make a covenant. He plants a tree there, and he sojourns there. Before we go to this next and final and arguably perhaps the most difficult section of this Torah portion, and we're running a bit late, but I guess we'll go a little bit later tonight anyway. There is a lot of material in here to cover. Let's think just about a couple more aspects of things that we've seen Abraham do and the things that seem to bother Abraham and some of the things that show up in his character as a result. And let's compare the character of the men, Lot, and in particular, Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, remember that battle that we had a Torah portion or so ago? The five kings versus the four kings? One of them might have even been Nimrod, maybe not, but one of them was clearly the king of Sodom. This has been asked in the form of a question, and it's not one that I'd given much thought to. This is probably the first year it really kind of connected with me. Hey, there really is a difference here. Remember when the king of Sodom tries to give Abram then some stuff, And he says, look, I'm not going to take so much as a stitch from you. I don't want anybody saying the king of Sodom made me wealthy. No way, Jose. Ain't taking it. And yet, twice now, we've seen pharaohs, kings of Egypt, give Abraham a whole bunch of stuff. Twice for things that arguably he had done wrong. Right? Now, the funny thing about this is, at least in terms of the context of the times and what we would say still, the laws of war, he was entitled to take Sodom's stuff. Right? As prize, as the victuals, the spoils of war. And yet, arguably, in the case of Pharaoh, you know, why would he take Pharaoh's gifts? But he's taken a whole bunch of sheep and things that both of those two kings, the two pharaohs of Egypt, have given him. So basically, it boils down to this. Is he really saying that Egypt is that much better off than Sodom? You see what I'm saying? He is more than willing to take stuff from the pharaohs, the nasty kings of Egypt, that he's just finished telling Abimelech, like, look, I don't trust you guys. You aren't God-fearing dudes at all. I'm afraid you're going to kill me so you can sleep with my wife. But I'll take your stuff. But when it comes to Sodom, these guys must be some kind of scumballs. Yes, it's true. We get the word sodomy from Sodom. There's a whole lot of nasty stuff going on there. We've seen the story with Lot. Bunch of rapists. But it's not just that. They are nasty, too, to the ger, to the stranger. The history and other things say, essentially, people that went into Sodom oftentimes didn't come out again. They got robbed, they got raped, they got killed. This was a really, really, really nasty place. And Lot picked it? There are a whole lot of things in this picture that just begin to say, yeah, the pieces fall into place here. One other thing. Compare the behavior of the men of Sodom and compare the behavior of Abimelech. Both of them, if you will, get rebuked by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and or his messenger, somebody that comes in his name, right? What is the reaction of the king Abimelech? Hey, straight down fly right. Keep your hands off of Sarah. So far, I have withheld your hand. You touch her, you're a dead man. Okay. I think I understand. I'm going to tell everybody we're okay. You and me, Lord, right? Yeah, remember Bill Cosby? I'm going to give him a whole bunch of stuff, too. Send him on his way. What is the reaction of the men of Sodom? They're going to break down the door. You blind us? We're still breaking down the door. You tell us that we're going to be dead? You rebuke us? We're not listening. Well, we see what happens to them, too. The picture here is really beginning to fall into place, I guess. And I see the question on the screen. Why didn't the Sodomites abuse Lot and his family when he moved to town? And it's a good question. I've kind of wondered the same thing myself. I think, there's an old joke about lawyers, and I'm going to say it, but I'm going to leave it go. Professional courtesy, right? Remember the lawyer jumps out of the boat in a shark-infested water, and the shark's all apart, and he walks to shore? Professional courtesy. Well, I don't know that that's what's happening in the case with Lot here. It may simply be that he had some protection. It's obvious that when it came to getting Lot out of Sodom, that he had protection. So, I mean, that would seem to be the obvious answer, but Scripture doesn't really tell us. It's just an interesting question and something to speculate about. Did I miss any other questions? Okay. I don't think so. But what we want to talk about next, having set up all of the character stuff, and we've seen, if you will, some growth in the character of Abram. He has passed tests. The sages will talk about a number of tests that he's passed time after time. And then we get to chapter 22, and it tells us here that it came to pass after these things, after these words, Ha-Debarim, words. Well, after which things? After which words? We're talking about the story we just had? Abimelech and Abraham making this covenant? Or is it other things? Well, it's not necessarily clear. But it says here that this time Elohim is going to prove. Nisa. Test. Even in some renderings, it could be provoke Abraham. With what has become known as the binding of Isaac, the Akidah. Right? People have heard that name, the binding. Now, I want to point out, before I go through the story here, we're not actually going to see that there is a command to bind Isaac that comes from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. When we get there, we'll talk about that. But at least in terms of the Akidah, the name for this story, the binding of Isaac, we're going to lay out a number of questions, some of which, I'll admit to you up front, we're not going to have answers to. At least, not yet, by the time the story's over. He says, Abraham! I love the response. This is another one of those Hebrew words people ought to learn, because it appears over and over again in Scripture. Everybody know this one? Hineni. Hineni. Here I am! And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says to him, take now your son, your only son. What does that mean? We know he's got Ishmael. Well, we've also been told, of course, that the promise, the son of promise, the one whom all of the promises that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has made to you are going to come through Isaac. He was the son that was the son of his old age through his wife Sarah that was promised and delivered upon. Your son whom you love, even Isaac, get into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains that I'm going to tell you of. Turns out that particular mountain is a very famous mountain. It's going to be the place where a whole lot of other stuff throughout the rest of history is going to happen, including the tabernacle. Abraham got up early in the morning. He saddled his ass, took two of his young men and Isaac his son. He got some wood. He rose up and he went, as he had been told. On the third day, he lifted up his eyes, sees the place in the distance, and he says to his young men, you all stay here. I'm going to go with the lad up yonder. We will worship and come back to you. Now, at this point, I'm going to tip my hand. Most of you, if you've heard me talk about this in years past, will know that let's talk about the things that are problematic in here. And what I'm going to do as I go through this is not just offer some of my own observations, but I got some other ones as well from, in particular, some fellows that I've read before that I kind of like that are going to say some things. And they have a little bit of a Jewish perspective, too, which I think in this particular story is kind of valuable. Because, as you know, there are a lot of people that will draw connections immediately with the sacrifice of the Lamb, the Son of God, and so forth. And I don't have a problem with some of that. I do think that there are probably some churchianity kind of things that get tossed in here that don't necessarily reflect a Torah understanding. So I want to try to be careful and make sure that as we go through this, we're looking and seeing what the text actually says and trying to build, you know, line by line, precept by precept on the things here. Let me go first to this story from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. And he says, this is one of the most famous stories, episodes in the Torah, but also one of the most morally problematic. Here's where we get started, right? Take your son, your only son whom you love, go offer him there for a burnt offering. Are we talking about child sacrifice here? If we're talking child sacrifice, there's something that is just plain anti-Torah. This is now a complete violation of the character of Yah and of Abraham. Right? Abraham, now stop a second and ask yourself the question. Here's how I want to introduce this. This is the same Abraham, mind you, who heard that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was going to what? Burn Sodom and Gomorrah, and he dickers with God. Hey, let's just stop here a second. I'm going to remind him of some things. Where's the dickering here? Right? Why is he not saying, well, wait a minute. You got to burn my son. You want me to what? You want me to burn my son up? Are you kidding? Peradventure, I might say, let me, since I got away with dickering you down from 50 to 10, how about if I go from 1 to 0 on this one? Okay. In other words, he is concerned. Now, we just finished with this other story. Here we have Abraham going to have to send Hagar and Ishmael out into the desert where they're not for sure going to die, but they might. And he's the text tells us he's very concerned about that. But we don't get a word here. We don't get a word about Abraham being concerned at all. And yet this is a morally problematic story. This is the kind of story that, people shake their heads and say, can't happen. I've had people that call themselves Bible scholars tell me, that ain't right. That story didn't happen. The God that I know would not do that. And the God that I know, too, he wouldn't send his own son. None of that stuff. I'm not believing any of this. And yet we've got this long character study. We see Abraham. We have this comparison with Lot. Now, Lot, I can say, maybe Lot would go with it. I'm just going to pretend I didn't hear that. Who knows what Lot would have done? I can think of a bunch of things depending upon the situation. But Abraham, not a peep. I'm going to suggest to you, and I saw it put this way. I think this is a great way to put it. Where's the line here? Never even crossed their mind. Is the line. Never even crossed the mind of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, nor of Abraham, that Isaac wasn't going to do exactly what he just said in verse 3. No, it's verse 5. We're going to go up the hill. We'll come back in a while. You with me? Everybody understanding why this is not as morally problematic, I would suggest up front, as it has been said? Yeah, I see the comment on the screen. He had a good night's sleep, too. Got up early in the morning. I don't think there's any concern in Abraham at all. I'll tell you how I read this story now, having been through it and read it and seen it a bunch of times. This is me. I try to say this without breaking down and crying, because it's such a wonderful story of laughter. Okay? I think Abraham is excited. I think he is thinking to himself, all right, oh man, I have seen some pretty good stuff, okay? I have seen the creator of the universe work some amazing miracles, but whoa, just wait till tomorrow. I don't know how this is going to work out, but man, am I anxious to be there. I think he's looking forward to it. I think he's looking forward to it, and I'll say it this way, the same way that all of us need to be looking forward to the nasty you-know-what hitting the fan that the world is scared to death of, that we're going to get to see one of the most amazing events in human history. You want to know how to deal with fear not? Get excited about it. Laugh about it. We get to see the hand of God at work. And that's exactly how I think Abraham is looking at this situation. Y'all stay here. We're going to go up the hill and see something I bet you wish you were going to see. And Abraham, when I was a kid, this, what does he do? The binding of Isaac. Does he take Isaac hog time, throw him over the ass so that he can't escape? I'm taking you up the hill, son. Gonna burn you alive. No. Isaac is going with him willingly. How can this be? What is going on here? Okay. We do see some elements of the discussion, and I'm going to pause and go back to these other commentaries from the rabbis here, because I think this is interesting stuff, obviously. They have some additional things that kind of help to flesh out the story, but I think you're starting to get the picture. So I wanted to lay out my own take to begin with on why I think this is such good stuff, not at all problematic morally, not at all an issue with the Torah, if we understand in context. Okay, Abraham took the wood, he laid it upon Isaac, his son, he took in his hand the fire and the knife, and they both of them went together. Hey, come on, Dad, you got the wood, got the fire, got the knife, yeah. And Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and he said, my father, hineni, here I am, my son. And he said, look, hey, we got the fire, there's the wood, where's the lamb for the burnt offering? Now, when I read this, I'm kind of wondering, Does he? Is this the first time he's really asking the question? Or does he kind of have a clue? I kind of suspect he has a clue. But what he's doing here, this is Markology, this is my speculation, is just laying it out so that, behold, for all time, we have a record of the conversation. So we know that everybody is on board with exactly what's going on here. Okay? Maybe this is news to him, maybe it's not. But I love the phraseology. And I think the phraseology, by the way, it's correct in the Hebrew and the English, as near as I can tell. Elohim will provide himself, the lamb, for a burnt offering, my son. So, the two of them walked together. What does Solomon say? Can two walk together unless they're in agreement? I don't think Abraham had a doubt about this. Maybe he knows more than we've even been told. How much of a vision does he have? I don't know. But they came to the place where they'd been told about. He built the altar there. He laid the wood in order, and he bound Isaac, his son, and he laid him upon the altar, upon the wood. Okay, pause. This is the binding of Isaac, the Akedah. The Midrash says that at this point, now this is the claim, if you will, that Isaac asked to be bound. You got to expect that he could not possibly, the 100-year-old guy probably couldn't have bound the son who, the sages say, probably not quite 40 years old. He's not a boy at this point. The best guess that I've seen over and over again is, best we can tell, he was probably about 37 years old. The point is, he's a young man. He's vigorous. Had he not wanted to go voluntarily, he wouldn't have gone. Had he not wanted to be bound, I don't think Dad could have bound him. Whack him over the head, maybe, and while he's... that's not what happened. Okay? The Midrash then suggests, the spirit is willing, Dad, but the flesh is weak. You know, when the flames start licking on me, or... I don't know. Best you tie my hands just to make sure, so that this goes according to plan. We do not know exactly what happened. That's the kinds of things that men have speculated about. But what we do know is it says he did bind Isaac, his son. He stretched forward his hand. He took the knife to slay his son. And here we pause for a message from our sponsor, right? We're going to pause and talk about some of the other things that are the elements of this story. We've mentioned this is a test. How far does the test go before we see the successful completion of the test? Is it walking up the hill? Right? Is it tying his son? Building the altar? Putting him on the altar? Is it raising the knife? Is it plunging the knife in? Or slicing his throat? I don't know. And there's some ambiguity. But I do think this is interesting. Okay? Let me just read a couple of lines from Rabbi Sacks. The conventional reading of this passage is that Abraham was being asked to show his love for Elohim, to show that his love was even greater than his son. Well, okay, I don't have a big problem with that. He was willing to sacrifice his son, the very son for whom he had spent a lifetime waiting. Now, I saw another Midrash that had a nice way of putting it that I liked even better. And it basically boils down to this. This is his whole life's meaning, right? Think about it. What is everything that Abraham has been living his life for boiled down to? Your seed. I'm going to make of you a great nation. Through your seed, all the kingdoms, all the earth will be blessed. And here he is being told, I've made this promise to you. Take your entire, it's not just your son, that's a big enough deal already. This is the entire meaning of your whole life, Abraham. Are you willing to lay this down? Not a peep. No dickering. Peradventure, my wife's life's meaning? None of that. None of that. Okay? I like the response. Now, what the rabbi here does says Maimonides answers. God didn't need Abraham to prove his love for him. Rather, the test was meant to establish for all time and for everybody else that would later look back on how far the fear and the love of God are supposed to go. It's a bigger picture, if you will. Rabbi Sacks talks about Kierkegaard. Everybody wants to talk about Kierkegaard, a book called Fear and Trembling, and the so-called Leap of Faith. Okay, maybe there's some interesting stuff in there. Quite frankly, I didn't find all of that compelling. So I'm going to skip down to some of the comments that that Rabbi Sacks makes, just to say that when it comes to the leap of faith, I think there's a lot more to it than Kierkegaard is pointing out. But he gives us, this is Rabbi Sacks, and gives us some more interesting empirical evidence, historical evidence, sociological evidence about the times. And it helps to put some of this in perspective. We know from the Tanakh and from other evidence that, you know what? Child sacrifice was not that unusual in this time frame. Not rare in the ancient world at all. It was commonplace. The Tanakh mentions a couple of places where pagan kings, Meshach, king of Moab, those folks again, did so. Then there was Jephthah, arguably one of the least admirable leaders in the book of Judges. We know what happens with his daughter. At least we maybe know what happened with his daughter. Two of the most wicked kings in Scripture, Ahaz and Manasseh, introduced the practice into Judah, and they were condemned for that. There's also archaeological evidence that shows the bones of thousands of young children, indicating that the practice of child sacrifice was widespread in places like Carthage and in Phoenicia. It was a common pagan practice. And two, this kind of makes sense too, child sacrifice is regarded with horror throughout Scripture. He quotes Micah, asking rhetorically, "Shall I give my firstborn for my sin, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?" And the response, "He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does Yahuwah require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before your God." How could Abraham possibly serve as a role model if he was prepared to do, without a second thought, without protest, what in fact all of his descendants, the very fruit of his loins, his seed, were commanded not to do? Right? The disconnects here go so deep, something is horribly wrong, unless we come to the obvious conclusion. Abraham simply knew better. Okay? He knew, well, A, his own character was consistent. He's not the kind of guy that was going to do that. He was concerned about Ishmael. And B, he knows the character of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Literally, I'm thinking laughter again. Joyfully, he knows this character. He was chosen to be a role model as a father, Elohim says, "For I've chosen him so that he will instruct his children and his household after him to keep the way of Yahuwah by doing what is right and just. Take me as a sacrifice." No, we didn't even hear that. Why? Again, because the thought never even entered Abraham's mind that Isaac wasn't going to do exactly what Abraham had been promised was going to come through him. And, of course, at this point, Lord Jonathan Sacks disses the Kierkegaard suspension of ethical principle kind of things and says, come on. That idea basically would give carte blanche to any religious fanatic to commit anything they want in the way of crimes in the name of God. This is the same logic as the Inquisition, the suicide bomber, and, of course, Nazi Germany. In order to understand what's being said here, he contends, you got to realize that much of the Torah, and in specific, the book of Genesis, is a polemic against worldviews that the Torah calls pagan, abomination, inhuman, wrong. And then he goes back and talks a little bit more about some of the ancient civilizations and notes that the standard practice was, as long as there was a father that was alive, the sons were considered property. The sons were considered property of the father till the father died. They had status, and that, by the way, persisted well into the Roman era. And ultimately what he says is, look, the Torah is opposed to that worldview, hook, line, and sinker. Every element of it is antithetical to Torah. And by the way, we're not supposed to make sacrifices to the dead. Ultimately what this is boiled down to, and I'll cut to the chase, is Torah is about life and not death. And there are a number of other things that he's going to outline that just plain don't wash with Torah. And that this story is basically putting the lie to a number of those. For example, we know that generally property would pass to the firstborn. Still does. It's just that Torah gives us some exceptions to the universal principle that it always goes to the firstborn. Not to Ishmael, but to Isaac. Not to Esau, the firstborn, but to Yaakov. Not to the tribe of Reuben, remember, of the 12 tribes of Jacob, but to Levi when it came to the priesthood, and to Judah, neither of which were the firstborn when it came to kingship. Oh, and by the way, who was the firstborn of Aaron and Moshe? Aaron. He ended up being the high priest, but it was Moshe that was the major leader and prophet. So, the principle that the story illustrates here, he says, is that when it comes from birth to binding, this story opposes the idea that the child is the property of the father to do as you like with. Isaac's birth is miraculous. And ultimately, it boils down to this. The test wasn't, he contends, whether Abraham would sacrifice his son, but whether, now listen carefully, the difference would sound subtle, but it's not, whether he is willing to give the son to God. All right, I'm going to say that again. The test is not whether he will sacrifice the son, kill him. Abraham already knows Isaac isn't dying. Right? We know that. He's excited about it. He knows that he and the boy are coming down the mountain, he and the young man. Question is, he's your life's work. It is through him that the promise comes. You love him. Will you now give him in every way to Elohim? He's yours. I've given him to you. Will you give him back to me? Here's the line that helps to nail that down. What Elohim was doing when he asked Abraham to offer up his son was not requesting a child sacrifice, but something quite different. What he was asking Abraham to do was renounce this concept of ownership of his son. I gave him to you. Now, what will you do with him? He was establishing as a principle of Torah that children are not the property of their parents, nor, I note, this is me adding this, nor are they the property of the village, right? They are the responsibility of the parents. Stewardship. He's going to go a little further. But first, a look back. Look at the very first human child. What is it that Eve, Chava, says over her first child? With the help of Yahuwah, I have acquired, Kadati, a man. I've acquired a man. I got me a property here. Got this little guy. Whose name comes from the verb to acquire. Kadati, Cain. He became, coincidentally, the first murderer. The rabbi tries to draw this lesson. I guess you can't argue with it. If you seek to own your children, they may rebel. Okay, so where he's headed here is that ultimately the idea of individuality, of children not being so much the property of the parents, but of moral entities, moral agents, independent, able to make their own choices. Hey, what's the essence of Torah? Choose. Choose this day whom you will serve. Honor your father and your mother. Obey them. But you're your own person. I'm going to hold you responsible. You don't die for the sins of the father, right? The Torah represents the birth of the individual when it comes to this concept of moral life and moral responsibility. The children belong to Elohim. Parenthood is not ownership, but guardianship, responsibility. And, of course, at an age, 12 for girls, 13 for boys, says the traditional Jewish understanding, they become independent moral agents of their own. So, offer him up as a burnt offering. Abraham is proof that there's more going on here. He knows something that we need to make sure we know. Elohim, God, Yahuwah, is a God of life. So many other religions worship death. Look at all the tattoos that you see on the pagan things of death and skulls and crossbones and all these nasty symbols that are just nothing but death. It is antithetical to Torah. Elohim, our creator, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, is a God of life. Abraham knew that. When he walks up the hill, he's going to walk down joyfully in laughter because he knows that this is all about life. And by the way, right, if you want to look ahead to the rest of the story and ask yourself the question, what does it foreshadow? We're talking about other forms of life. And with that, I'll read one more bit of commentary. This comes from another rabbi saying that, hang on just a second. We've lost the picture again.
Oh, I lost it a while ago.
Okay. Oh, well, I'm not sure whether we're online or not, but we'll edit and we'll get the recording up. Can death be temporary? If death can be temporary, says this piece from Rabbi Ari Kahn, if the body can be healed, reunited with the soul, then, well, at least one of the moral issues with the Akidah disappears. This is something that tends to elude, says this guy, and this is why I mention it here in this context, the concept of modern Judaism. Abraham was to have killed Yitzhak, and subsequently, maybe he was going to return from the dead. Right at the point where Abraham goes up the hill, he doesn't know how this is going to work out. Maybe he's going to kill Abraham. Abraham's going to kill Isaac, and then there's going to be this miraculous resurrection. We don't know. Matter of fact, there are still some to this day that think that's maybe what did happen. And he quotes a couple that I'll get to in a second. Anyway, this idea of resurrection, well, that certainly is consistent with what they call modern Jewish thought. It's consistent with Torah. It's considered a basic principle of faith. Nevertheless, and here's why I think this is interesting, they say since the idea was hijacked by Christianity and made a central tenet of that religion, Jews seem to want to distance themselves from the concept. Okay? Because there may be those overtones in here, and people say, oh, this is the Lamb of God, this is Jesus that's being foreshadowed. They tend to basically kind of, well, do what maybe Lot was doing. Not look there. If you don't want to know the answer, don't ask the question. And he says, we still want to distance ourselves from that concept, despite the fact that we confirm this principle of faith in our prayers 3 times every day. But there are still commentaries, Midrashim, some of the sages that have said for centuries that somehow or other Yitzhak may have died in the process. Okay, I mention this just for completeness. Scripture is literally a little bit ambiguous on it. It says, it seems to say at least.
You're only speaking to us, by the way.
I know. It seems to say. It seems to say, I say again, Abraham took his knife, stretched it forth to slay his son. And then we hear he was told, Abraham, Abraham, and then he responds, Hineni. How much time, right? Did he or did he not? Well, there is a famous rabbi, Rav Yehuda, who says, when the sword reached his throat, the soul of Isaac ascended, and he died for a second. Okay, like he had an out-of-body experience. In other words, I had you bind me for a reason, Dad. I was afraid this was going to scare me to death. I know I'm coming back, okay? Again, there's so much here we don't know for sure because we just don't have all the details. I like that about the Torah. Anyway, when he heard the Almighty saying, don't raise a hand to the boy, then his soul went back into his body, says this rabbi. And he got up and he stood on his feet. And then, they say, because of this experience, Yitzhak now has a, if you will, a life experience that no one else has. He knows. He's seen it. He knows about the resurrection. And he said, Baruch Haba, you who resurrects the dead. Okay? Is this true? We don't know. It's an interesting speculation. But the point is, in all of these ways of looking at this, what some call morally problematic scenario, there are some things we can say we're not sure about, and there are some other things we can reject out of hand. Again, the obvious. It's not about child sacrifice. This is not about Abraham being asked to violate the Torah or to do something that's out of character for either him or for the Almighty, because all of them know one thing. The bad stuff didn't enter their mind. It's about walking in obedience. It's about doing the things that he tells us to do, because we know his character, and we know that he is a God of life. And ultimately, that's what the story says that is so amazing to us. I know, he says in conclusion, don't lay your hand upon the lad. Don't do anything to him, for now I know that you are a God-fearing man. You've not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Back to what it was that Jonathan Sacks says. He's willing to give his son to the Creator. By the way, we see that theme again in Scripture too. Places like Samuel, given to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in the womb. Abraham lifts up his eyes. Look, here's the ram. He gets the ram. He offers him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. And he called the name of that place Yahuwah Yireh, in the mount where Yahuwah is seen. Yahuwah Yireh. You'll hear it called Jehovah Jireh too, but Yahuwah Yireh. And now he hears again from heaven. By myself, says Yahuwah, have I sworn, because you have done this thing, you have not withheld your son, your only son, in blessing I will bless you. Remember, in dying you shall die, in blessing I will bless you. And in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, sand like upon the seashore. Your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. You knew this was true before. Now you've walked it, and I'm telling you, it is, because you have hearkened to my voice. You have shema'd. Abraham returned, went back, just as he'd said he would, to Beersheba. He dwelt there. And then we get a little bit of an indication about the his brother's sons. Brother Nahor tells us about Uz, his firstborn, his brother Buzz, and on down. And his concubine, too. Name was Reumah. She bore Teba, Gaham, Tahash, and Ma'aka, four sons unto Nahor as well. And with that, folks, the Torah portion ends.